From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and we start with more promising news in the development of a coronavirus vaccine. Drug maker AstraZeneca and the University of Oxford said today that trials of their vaccine show it is highly effective, preventing the disease in the majority of people who took it. Earlier this month, Pfizer and Moderna said their vaccines appear to be about 95% effective. Let's bring in Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat from Louisiana. Governor, welcome. And first of all, the virus is surging again in Louisiana and across the country. Will you be ready to immediately get a vaccine out to the public once it's approved?
Yes. We've been working extremely hard, and we're coordinating directly with General Perna, who is running Operation Warp Speed, at least from a logistical distribution perspective. Last week, we were one of five or six states to actually have a green status on this. But that is not to say that we're comfortable. We're continuing to refine our plan every day and making sure that the folks across the state of Louisiana understand what that plan is. And you know, there are complexities around ultra-cold storage. There's complexities around the fact that depending on which vaccine you're talking about, you have to have two doses, either 21 days apart or 28 days apart. And we think we might start administering vaccines in the second half of December. Don't know the date yet and don't know how many doses we will get initially, but we feel really good about where we are.
Well, Governor, as you know, African Americans are dying at disproportionately high rates in this pandemic. Do you have a plan to make sure that the vaccine is distributed equally among different populations of people?
Well, first of all, we were the first state in the nation to report the disparate impacts of COVID-19 on people by race. Very shortly thereafter, I created a health equity task force, and that task force is helping us in every aspect to respond to COVID-19 with resource allocation and different planning. And by the way, it's going to go beyond this pandemic, too, because the pandemic just put a bright light on something that's been a problem for us for a long time. But we know we have too many poor people, too many African Americans who have hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, obesity, those types of things, and our hospitals to make sure that we have an equitable plan for the allocation of the vaccines. And that is a key pillar in our approach.
How concerned are you about the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday? We've all seen the pictures of packed airports over the weekend.
Yeah, very concerned. Thanksgiving should not look this year like it's looked in previous years. And by the way, Christmas either. Do it with people who are part of your immediate household and then virtually join the others together, whether it's a Zoom meeting or maybe a telephone call. I'll be staying home with my wife. And, you know, I came from a family that were eight kids. My mom is still with us, and I let her know that for the first time in many years, we're just not going to be gathering. And if people insist on doing this for Thanksgiving, there will be a lot of families that come Christmas, they will regret it.
Governor, on the issue of coronavirus relief, how urgent is the economic crisis in Louisiana? And should Democrats approve a more modest relief package, less than the $2 trillion deal that Nancy Pelosi is trying to get through the House?
Look, if the Democrats in the House have something that's a little over $2 trillion and the Republican-controlled Senate says a trillion, somewhere between those two numbers is a compromise. They need to get to it. It is incredibly important. Our unemployment insurance trust fund is at zero. And I really believe that one more round of stimulus would do it, because with any luck, by May or so, we will have administered enough vaccine to create finally the kind of herd immunity that people have been talking about. And I'm encouraging Congresswoman Pelosi, I should say Speaker Pelosi, and the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, to sit down and figure this thing out. It is sad that there's so much that they agree on, and they still can't move forward on things that they agree upon.
Before I let you go, Congressman Cedric Richmond, a Democrat from New Orleans, has been tapped to serve as one of President-elect Joe Biden's senior advisors. And progressives in the party, as you know, took issue with that because of his ties to the oil and gas industry. How do you think Joe Biden is walking this line as he tries to navigate the rift between moderates and progressives in your party?
Well, look, I think he's doing just fine. And the idea that somebody who is a congressperson from Louisiana should be disqualified from working in the White House because they accepted contributions from the oil and gas industry is just ridiculous. Like it or not, fossil fuels are going to be around for decades longer. There will be a transition to cleaner and renewable forms of energy, but that transition is going to take a long time. And right now we need sensible, common sense folks who are controlling the policies there. Cedric Richmond will do a wonderful job in the White House. I'm looking forward to working with him and with President-elect Joe Biden, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. And this purity test that too many people are wanting to impose, whether it's people on the far right or the far left, is crazy. The vast majority of the American people are bunched somewhere near the center of the political spectrum. And by God, they need a voice too.
Would you consider a spot in the Biden administration, if asked?
I am very happy right here in Louisiana. I was just reelected last year. I am happy where I'm at. We've got a lot of really important work to do as we continue to respond to COVID. I had 3 hurricanes hit Louisiana this year. We've got a lot of recovery that we have to take care of, and I'm not asking for anything. Don't expect anything to come my way from the Biden administration.
John Bel Edwards, Governor of Louisiana, thank you very much for your time today.
Peter, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Well, President-elect Joe Biden is assembling his cabinet and has selected 6 people for his foreign policy and national security teams, including longtime foreign policy advisor Anthony Blinken as Secretary of State. Blinken is 58 years old, and he served as Deputy Secretary of State and Deputy National Security Advisor in the Obama administration when Biden was Vice President. For a deeper look, we're joined now by Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also a former State Department Middle East analyst, advisor, and negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. Welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here, Tanya.
Yeah, so Aaron, we're starting to see the makeup of President-elect Biden's security team and cabinet. Among them, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, will be climate czar. Avril Haines to be the Director of National Intelligence. What signal is Joe Biden sending with these choices?
You know, I think we're moving into a period where you're going to have a foreign policy team, the 6 people you've mentioned. You haven't mentioned all of them. Basically, are tethered not to the political and personal interests and, frankly, vanities of a single man, but to something that all of them would agree is the American national interest. And frankly, that's a radical departure from the foreign policies of the Trump administration, where policy in large measure was in fact inextricably linked with the president's own personal and political agenda. So I think that's the key point of departure. Second, having worked for 6 secretaries of state, I can tell you that the sine qua non is a close relationship with the president. It takes American allies and adversaries about 5 minutes to figure out whether or not a Secretary of State is speaking with the authority and confidence and trust of the president. And Tony Blinken, having worked with Joe Biden since the 80s and probably knowing him as well as any of the foreign policy professionals with which Biden has dealt, actually has that kind of a relationship. Whether the world will cooperate, whether or not you can actually solve some of these very difficult problems is another matter. But Biden has picked someone who he trusts and someone he's prepared to empower.
Well, you actually know Tony Blinken. I want to ask you about some of the others. We're also seeing that Jake Sullivan is being nominated for National Security Advisor, and diplomat Linda Thomas-Greenfield is expected to be named United States Ambassador. Your thoughts on them?
I mean, again, they've all worked together. They all know one another. I think you can virtually almost guarantee, and although the tick-tock of governance is a lot different than campaigning or the period before governance, you can guarantee a certain harmonious interaction. A lot of the bureaucratic games that we've seen, not just in the Trump administration, but in other administrations, I think will not be played. And I think they all have a more or less a similar view of the world. I don't think that they would tell you, Tanya, if they were speaking to you, that America is the pivotal, indispensable power that can solve all the world's problems. But I think they would all argue that American leadership must be restored, and it is central to solving some of them. They believe deeply in alliances. They're wary, I think, of foreign intervention. all know the process of how government works. And that's the other thing. Remember, we've got a delayed transition here, which means that they're going to be behind the clock considerably. And you really do need people who know government, who know the process, and who can begin to advise the president accordingly.
Well, before I let you go, I just have a minute with you. You were talking in detail about the role of the Secretary of State. What do you make of these stories that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu actually met with the Saudi Crown Prince, who was also meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo?
Yeah, you know, Saudi Foreign Minister is denying this, but I'm certain the meeting took place, and it's the result of at least a decade of emerging Israeli-Saudi relations in response to a rising threat from Iran and Sunni jihadists. The Trump administration, I think, it is probably their most significant diplomatic accomplishment in the region. They invested heavily in this. I would argue at the expense of the Palestinian issue, but it may well be, Tanya, that the Israel-Arab state normalization process might actually create a better environment, which would allow some modest progress on the Israeli-Palestinian issue as well.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you.
The Ohio Attorney General said today that he'll go to court to suspend a member of Cincinnati's city council. P.G. Sittenfeld was arrested late last week and now faces federal corruption charges. He's the third member of the council to face bribery charges this year. Let's get more from Howard Wilkinson. He's the senior political analyst for member station WVXU in Cincinnati. Howard, welcome. This is stunning. Councilman Sittenfeld was accused of taking $40,000 in bribes in exchange for votes on a development project. What more can you tell us?
Well, this really was stunning, and it's been stunning, you know, to have three of these situations this year on city council. We've had council manager form of government for almost 100 years, and there had never been a council member arrested and charged with a felony crime. Sittenfeld has a different view of this thing, obviously, but he was taking bribes in exchange for votes on a development contract, but the money was going into a PAC that he was kind of building slowly to run for mayor in 2021.
What about the other cases? Three council members total have been arrested and charged. Two of them are Democrats, one's a Republican. Are any of these cases connected to each other, or are they all isolated?
Well, they're pretty much isolated, except for the fact that the Republican, Jeff Pastor, has been indicted in the same development project as P.G. Sittenfeld. But in Pastor's case, he is accused of pocketing the money, as is the Democrat Tamaya Denard, who was arrested in February and pled guilty to one count in June. She is actually to be sentenced tomorrow morning on her count, but they're not related. It's part of a very large FBI operation, the U.S. District Attorney of Southern Ohio. It may not be over yet.
Yeah, well, and just briefly, I mean, we're in a moment now in the United States where Americans are struggling with trust in government. How is all of this going over with the people of Cincinnati?
Well, it's not going over very well because we're just, you know, people in Cincinnati are just not used to this. This has not happened. You know, city council has acted in a silly manner before, but never in a criminal manner, and they're used to that. But they're not used to this kind of thing, and people are not happy. And it's disrupted the mayoral campaign for next year because Sittenfeld was the leading candidate.
Howard Wilkinson, we're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
Well, and before the pandemic, a lot of us had not heard of Zoom, if you can believe that. But since March, the video conferencing platform has skyrocketed in popularity, connecting office workers, families, and friends. But advocates for people with hearing loss say that Zoom hasn't connected everyone, and that's because Zoom's basic free video plans don't include real-time closed captioning. That service is only available to regular users for a monthly fee. Hearing health advocate Sherry Eberts is trying to make the service free for everyone. She's founder of the online community LivingWithHearingLoss.com. Sherry, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And how are people with hearing loss navigating the pandemic now that so much of our work is online, we're doing things remotely, we're not face-to-face, and often our mouths are covered with masks?
It has been a very challenging time for everybody, but definitely for people with hearing loss during the pandemic. As you mentioned, masks really take away our superpower of speech reading or lip reading in face-to-face conversations. And then on video conference calls, it is nice that you're able to see the person, but it still is very difficult to really follow conversations. The poor audio is usually a factor. Internet connections are sort of spotty. And especially if there's multiple people on the video conference call, it's hard to know where to look, who's speaking. It's definitely a challenge if you use lip reading to augment your residual hearing.
Sure. Can you, like, you know, because Zoom has become so normalized for all of us, can you kind of like just walk me through what a typical Zoom call might be like for somebody who has hearing loss?
Yeah, a typical Zoom call for someone with hearing loss is really tough and stressful. So you dial in early and you try and set yourself up so you're in speaker mode so that you have the largest possible picture of whoever is going to be speaking. But, you know, sometimes I'll connect with headphones to really try and improve the audio. But it's a very difficult situation. People have different audio quality in terms of the way they're speaking. Sometimes people are cutting in and out, and the image won't match their lip movements, and it won't match the sounds of their words. So it's very difficult to follow. And really, captioning was a very simple way to make that all go away. If we had captions, then it would be much easier for us to be able to follow the conversation and also to participate. You know, it's hard for us to want to jump in or to share our thoughts because we're not sure what's been said. And obviously, there's a lot of trepidation about looking silly or repeating something that someone just said. So it's definitely a stressful situation.
So to that point of captions, I mean, that's the solution. Right. And you wrote an open letter to video conferencing companies in the spring, soon after the pandemic broke out, Google, Microsoft, Zoom, and you asked them to make their captioning services free, which because now you can pay for them. Right. I mean, what became of that letter?
Well, it really was amazing. So like you said, in April, I wrote this open letter and I was amazed at the uptake. People with hearing loss really felt that it resonated with them. And someone suggested that I turn it into a petition. And so I did. And after about 5 days, we had 6,500 signatures. And I was pretty excited about that. But now we have almost 58,000 signatures. And if you read through the comments on that petition, you can see what an important issue this is for people with hearing loss. And Google pretty quickly moved its automatic speech recognition, or ASR captions as they're known, out from behind their paywall for everybody. And I was thrilled, and the hearing loss community was just thrilled. And about a month or so later, Microsoft did the same thing. And Zoom really has been the one to lag behind. And their platform is used the most often. So it really is the most challenging for people with hearing loss. And Zoom has very high quality ASR captions, but they are currently stuck behind a paywall. So if you don't have a premium plan, like a business plan or an enterprise plan, which cost about $200 a month, you're not able to access these captions. And I find that very disappointing.
Well, we reached out to Zoom to see if we could get some answers as well, but we didn't hear anything either. But walk me through this technology just a little bit more. This is kind of fascinating. I mean, what does it take to caption a live conversation like the one we're having now?
So the gold standard of captioning is something called communication access real-time translation. So I dare you to say that five times fast, but we call it CART. And that's where a live transcriber types what's spoken in real time. So there's actually a person there. But technology is rapidly catching up. And now there are a handful of these very high quality automatic speech recognition options. And this is where the computer just listens to what's spoken and is able to turn it into a written format. There are a number of different companies that do this. And I believe that Zoom has partnered with Otter, which is a company that has very high quality AI, and the accuracy is very, very good, and very good, especially for more personal communications.
I mean, that sounds complicated. So what do you say to people who might be listening to this and respond with, well, you know, to get a live person there to transcribe your conversation, that takes a lot of effort, that takes a lot of time and money. AI, computer-generated captioning, that's got to be complex. You should pay for it. What do you say to them?
Well, what I say is that you would never build a building, right, and include ramps, and then ask people in wheelchairs to pay to use them. And I think the same thing holds for people with hearing loss. In this case, the captions are our ramps, and the captions exist. The ASR captions exist, and they're behind the paywall, but I don't understand why we should have to pay to use the feature we require for equal access.
On your petition, many signers describe the alienation that they felt when they're not able to fully understand what's being said in a Zoom meeting. I just wonder if you could talk about the emotional impact of not having this resource, because from what I already know about hearing loss is that it can be isolating even in normal times.
That's absolutely right. And the lack of these captions on Zoom calls has taken a really huge emotional toll on people with hearing loss during this pandemic. I mean, everything has moved online, right? Work, school, social interactions, and entertainment. So imagine 7 months of social isolation, not only from in-person visits with your friends and family, but also without the ability to converse comfortably with them virtually either. And as you know, many people with hearing loss are seniors who may live alone. And so the isolation and the sadness can really be overwhelming.
Well, Sherry Ebers is a hearing health advocate and founder of the online community livingwithhearingloss.com. Sherry, thanks for sharing your experiences with me. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now in the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
The holiday shopping season usually starts with a bang the day after Thanksgiving, but Black Friday is probably going to be a little quieter this year as coronavirus cases surge to record levels nationwide. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, always good to speak with you. Welcome.
Thank you.
And it has been a tough year for retailers. I mean, we've been reporting on that for months now. How are they bracing for what should be their most important time of year?
Well, I think that they're trying to really prepare their shareholders and their employees to shift the expectations and to spread out this holiday season for as long a period as possible. This actually really began back for Amazon Prime Days a month ago, really when most retailers were already starting to unleash their quote unquote Black Friday deals, and to make this a longer season and really key in on the fact that e-commerce is going to drive very much of the conversation here. In fact, I was looking at some research that came out from Adobe. They do a lot of research on the e-commerce sector. And this was a mind-blowing statistic. They believe that online holiday spending will be up 33% from a year ago.
Oh,
and
wow.
That would be compared to overall growth of maybe 1.5% to 2.5%. So you can see we're looking at 2 years of growth for e-commerce in one season.
So sure, I mean, these big companies have pretty robust online operations, but at the same time, they still need people to go into their brick and mortar stores. And there's a lot of states around the country or cities around the country where these shops have restrictions. Are the companies trying to convince the government to loosen any of those up?
Absolutely. You know, it's been fascinating to see that there are essentially two types of retailers this year, right? The essential ones and non-essential. And many of the big retailers fall into non-essential. Right now, they are trying to actually lobby governments and hire lobbyists themselves to basically say, hey, we want there to be a little bit more flexibility. And Macy's CEO has said that the store has done a really great job of maintaining store safety. Gap has said that that they think that the idea of the idea of having these different status of essential versus non-essential is, quote, arbitrary and outdated. So I think that this is going to be a real struggle for retailers, because with viruses spiking, the government's going to do what the government wants to do.
Do you think people will go to the stores? I mean, look at the airports. People are getting on airplanes.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is certainly some group of people who really want to get out there and shop. There is pent-up demand for, you know, and we've seen that. We've got, if you're lucky enough to still have a job, you're saving more. Credit card balances are dropping. So maybe people want to spend some money. But I really have to underscore that we've, of course, have 10.1 million fewer jobs than we had at the beginning of this pandemic. And that's maybe the biggest limiting factor, that people who don't have work right now, they are not going to spend. They're not going out to spend. They're not going to spend online.
Well, exactly, Jill, especially if there's no more relief coming from the federal government.
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of the core issue, and that is that we've talked about this on the show, that we've seen a K-shaped recovery, meaning that we all kind of went down together, but our fortunes divided and the recovery part of the pandemic, and that is those who have jobs can spend money, those who don't are not spending money. So up, down of the K, it's going to continue.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thank you so much, as always.
Great to be with you, and happy early Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you too.
Here's a staggering figure. People in the U.S. owe nearly $1.7 trillion in student loan debt, according to the Federal Reserve. That's more than the nation owes in credit card debt or car loans. During this pandemic, payments on federal loans were temporarily halted until January, and the incoming Biden administration has said it would support some kind of student loan forgiveness. Joining us to take a look at those plans and the possible solutions to high student loan debt is Kevin Carey, Director of Education Policy at the think tank New America. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
And Kevin, this is a very basic but important question. Why are we seeing an increase in student loan debt?
There are multiple reasons. State governments have pulled money out of their public university systems, particularly after the Great Recession. And so a lot of public colleges and universities have increased tuition to make up the difference, and students have had to borrow in order to pay that increased tuition, especially because the economy hasn't done that well over the last 10 years for middle and lower income families. A lot of people lost wealth during the housing crash, never got it back. And so people didn't have home equity or other sources of savings to draw on. So they had to take out loans. Mm-hmm. Also, I think, you know, we live in a time where there's really no path to a good career that doesn't require some kind of degree, whether it's a four-year degree, a two-year degree, or something else. And so the demand for higher education continues to surge because of that lack of any kind of alternative. And so colleges are in a position to charge more prices if they want to. And so they've been doing a lot of that as well.
To your point about debt burden, it's not really equally shared, though. There are massive inequities between white students, for example, and black students, as well as other students of color, and both how students borrow and their ability to actually pay it back. Can you talk a little about that?
No, that's exactly right. And we've actually seen that problem get worse. There was a report from the Roosevelt Institute recently that said that from 2000 to 2018, among recent college graduates, the wealth gap between black recent college graduates and white recent college graduates has actually increased over time. And it's because black students borrow a lot more money to go to college. And that's because black households have suffered under a long history of discrimination in our country. We think about all the ways in housing discrimination, for example, where people couldn't build up any home equity because they weren't allowed to buy houses in certain neighborhoods, or they were charged very high interest rates. to the point where even, you know, often if you have two families, one white, one black, of similar income, the wealth is very different, and people pay for college with their savings, with their wealth. And so black mm-hmm. families have had to borrow more to go to college. They're also more likely to be recruited by predatory for-profit colleges, and it can be harder for them to get a job in the labor market after they graduate, which means it's harder to pay your loans back.
Mm-hmm. What has the incoming Biden administration signaled they're willing to work on regarding this?
President-elect Biden recently said that he supports legislation that was introduced in Congress earlier this year that would forgive the first $10,000 of people's student loans. And you know, part of the rationale there is that many of the people who actually struggle the most to pay their loans back don't have huge loans. Often they've dropped out of college or they might have, you know, again, gone to a bad for-profit college that charged them too much money. So just by forgiving the first $10,000, we could take care of a lot of people that are in delinquency or in default, while not giving too much money to high dollar borrowers who tend to be people who go to, say, law school or medical school and usually actually can pay their loans back just fine. He's also supported very ambitious legislation that would make many public colleges and universities free for people who make less than $125,000. Double the size of the federal Pell Grant program for low-income students. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Biden administration to act quickly, particularly if there's a divided Congress. There was the issue of student debt was enormously important in the primary campaign. You know, you could argue that Senator Bernie Sanders came close to the Democratic nomination twice on the issue of college affordability in student debt. Both Chuck Schumer, the highest ranking Democrat in the Senate, and Senator Elizabeth Warren, you know, another prominent Democrat, have called for forgiving the first $50,000 of student loan debt. And so I think debt forgiveness would be a way for the Biden administration to do something dramatic, do something early, and signal to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that it's serious about their concerns.
You know, Kevin, there are also questions of fairness to those who have recently paid off their loans. If some form of student loan forgiveness goes into effect, are those valid concerns?
I think they are valid concerns. If you pick a moment in time and forgive all the debt that exists on that day, then you're not giving the same benefit to someone who was in a similar circumstance and paid their loans off a few years ago. You're also not giving the same benefit to people in the future. And, you know, one of the dilemmas I think the Biden administration will face is that it's going to be pretty difficult to get comprehensive reform legislation through a divided Congress, particularly if mm-hmm. the Republicans maintain control of the Senate. There are some people who believe the Department of Education can actually unilaterally write down loans, since the vast majority of all student loans are held by the U.S. federal government. But then, you know, you're kind of solving the symptom, but you're not solving the underlying problem. And also, it's important to know that most loans are not taken out by students going to public colleges and universities. They're either people who go to private schools, which tend to be more expensive, or people going to graduate or law school, which tend to be more expensive. And so we'd be forgiving those loans now, but not in the future. And I do think those fairness issues start to make the politics tricky.
Kevin, if we do nothing about this problem of expanding student debt, what does the future look like?
I don't think that we can just go on forever as we are now, where debt just continues to pile up and pile up and pile up. I don't think the political system will stand for it. It's a drag on the ability of young people to start their careers and buy houses. It's bad policy. We want a more educated population. And it's not fair. You know, we had in this country for, you know, many decades a system where, you know, you could go to a public university and either by saving a little or, you know, working your way through college, get that degree and start your life without debt. And we don't have that anymore. I think people want to go back one way or the other. So I think it's a question of if not when these reforms will happen. But making policy in Washington, D.C. is never easy. So when exactly that happens is a little hard to tell.
That's Kevin Carey, Director of New America's Education Policy. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Student loan debt is just one of the many issues the incoming Biden administration has said it's taking on, including an ambitious plan for his first 100 days in office. Here he is speaking about the pandemic the Friday after Election Day.
I want everyone to know on day one, we're going to put our plan to control this virus into action. We can't save any of the lives lost, any of those who have been lost, but we can save a lot of lives in the months ahead.
In his first 100 days, Biden has promised a vaccine distribution plan and has asked Congress for a new aid bill to address the economic impacts of this pandemic. He also says he will rejoin the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Accord. Biden also promises to roll back President Trump's corporate tax cuts and to strengthen the Voting Rights Act. And he's promised to tackle police and criminal justice reform by creating a National Police Oversight Commission and working to reform sentencing and probation. We will follow all of President-elect Biden's promises and his actions once he takes office.
It is very difficult to find an American chestnut these days. The giant tree grew in eastern forests but has largely disappeared after a blight a century ago. Now, researchers have genetically engineered chestnuts to survive the blight, but that's splitting the conservation community. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Mike Aukett has been spending a lot of time in the woods this fall.
Here I am in the Allegheny National Forest, and I'm up on top of a ridge here.
The retired scientist walks over the rocky soil. It's covered with lowbush blueberries.
And this is the kind of place where you tend to find remnant surviving Americans.
American chestnuts were once common here. They were some of the largest, fastest-growing trees. The wood was rot-resistant and used in everything from cradles to coffins. The nuts fed wildlife and people. When American chestnuts succumbed to the blight, at least 5 species of insect went extinct. American chestnuts still grow in the forest. Aukett finds one that produced nuts 2 years ago, but the top of the tree now looks dead.
That shows that the blight is getting into it.
The blight is a fungus that was brought to the U.S. when chestnut trees were first imported from China and Japan. The fungus produces an acid in the tree, and while Asian varieties are adapted to fight it off, the acid creates a lethal canker on American chestnuts. People who want to see it tower in the eastern forests again have faced decades of disappointment. The roots continue to sprout and start to grow.
And as it grows, it'll get the blight again and get killed down again. And it's stuck in this cycle. Eventually, the roots run out of energy and the whole tree dies.
William Powell has been working to restore the American chestnut at the State University of New York in Syracuse for over 30 years. And he says people have been trying for much longer than that to make a hybrid chestnut that's resistant to the blight.
I've seen papers all the way back to the 1920s and, you know, hybridizing it with the Japanese chestnut, the Chinese chestnut, you know, all kinds of different things, trying to make blight-resistant trees. None of them have been successful getting it back out into the wild.
So Powell and his colleagues turned to genetic engineering. They figured out that a gene in the wheat plant enhances resistance to the fungus that causes the blight. So they've added that gene to the cells of the American chestnut.
And this gene makes an enzyme that actually detoxifies the acid that the fungus throws at the plant. And by giving the tree the ability to make this enzyme, you basically take away or neutralize the weapon of the fungus. And therefore, the fungus and the tree can coexist.
Powell and his team have successfully grown test plots of genetically engineered American chestnuts in New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Currently, these GMO trees are federally regulated and are required to be cut before they flower. Powell has petitioned the USDA to deregulate the trees so they can mature and reproduce. He says so far, the process has taken 5 years.
I get emails all the time, people wanting these trees. And I just have to keep telling them, well, once we get through the process, then you'll be able to get to these trees.
It's just so reckless, I guess, is the word that keeps coming to my mind. What's the rush?
This is Ann Peterman, director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, which has developed a coalition of hundreds of groups worldwide opposed to genetically engineered trees. Other GMO trees have been developed for commercial production to survive frost or insect pests. Peterman says the GMO American chestnut is designed not for farms, but to spread through forests. She worries this could have unintended consequences for the ecosystem.
It would be the first GMO plant in the world to be released with the intention of spreading in the wild. What will be the impact on the future generations of these genetically engineered trees? No one knows.
Peterman worries the GMO chestnut could be a Trojan horse, the first GMO tree approved in the U.S.
That precedent then makes it a lot easier to get other genetically engineered trees approved.
Sarah Fitzsimmons disagrees.
People saying this is a rubber stamp for other species, it's not.
She's director of restoration for the American Chestnut Foundation and is a research technologist at Penn State.
You know, the USDA takes two or more years for every application to carefully consider all the consequences of a decision that it makes.
The foundation plants hybrids throughout the eastern U.S., but Fitzsimmons says it's not been enough to restore the trees. So they support the genetically engineered, also called transgenic, American chestnut.
I am not of the opinion that transgenic American chestnuts are going to save and restore the species on its own. It needs to be coupled with other techniques, but it is an incredibly important tool, you know, not just for American chestnut, but for other native species.
Back at the Allegheny National Forest, Mike Auchett wishes people could just allow nature to take its own course. But he fears that's no longer possible.
If we don't act responsibly using the best tools that we have, things are going to get worse. They're not going to get better if we just let nature take its course, because I think the days of doing that, unfortunately, are over.
The proposal to deregulate the genetically engineered American chestnut will need approval from USDA as well as other federal agencies. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.